Thanks very much for the opportunity to be here. Thanks to all the CEDA organisers, Rosie and Kwai and Paula. And I'd like to add my acknowledgement to the traditional owners on which we meet. I've been asked to provide some broader reflections on technological change, on employment, and on my field in particular, which is technology, law, and governance. And I'd like to do that by starting with a story, offering a provocation, and ending with a challenge. The story takes us to post-war America in the mid-1950s and to two conferences. One is the fabled Dartmouth Conference on Artificial Intelligence, which coined the notion of artificial intelligence, or AI, that looms large over the future of work conversation today. At Dartmouth in 1956, the mathematician John McCarthy conjectured that every aspect of learning or any other feature of intelligence can in principle be so precisely described that a machine can be made to simulate it. He set a team of scientists to the task of finding how to make machines that use language, form abstractions and concepts, solve kinds of problems now reserved for humans, and improve themselves. But I want to talk about another John, John Diebold, the great popularizer of the notion of automation. In another American city, as McCarthy and his colleagues were contemplating how to replicate human cognition, Diebold was expanding on the spring that gave rise to a river, how military and espionage efforts developed during World War II had led to the development of machines that couldn't just assist with mechanization and process control, but that could process, handle, communicate, and crucially, retrieve information of an endless variety. Now, the important point of difference between these two Johns is that AI John projected technology that remains as distant today as it was in 1956. But the automation John projected technology that has absolutely come home to roost. He identified three domains in particular where information retrieval would be transformative. First, he identified the identification of medical statistics from medical records. Second, the translation of language. And third, modes of dealing with that enduring frustration of modern life, traffic. Now, to cut to one of my punchlines, what we've now collapsed into the terminology and all of the associated fears and projections of artificial intelligence perfectly distills to the realization of achievements in these three areas of automation. Pattern recognition in the medical context around diagnostic images, so these are the advances in breast cancer research and so on, although with a number of challenges still to be resolved, including demographic representation on breast cancer images and other diagnostic images that don't just relate to the Caucasian population. The second is on pattern recognition around great corpuses of written work, though again with many imperfections due to the complexities and the long learnings of language. And third is around pattern recognition for road vehicles, though with many difficulties in dealing with anything that's not perfectly calibrated on a horizontal camera span immediately in front of a vehicle. Diebold also recognised a fourth feature of automation, the terrible psychological freight of automation through social isolation. At the time, American factories instituted lonesome pay clauses, bonuses to compensate for a working life surrounded by input interfaces or screens. How times change. One wonders how future generations will look back on our willing servitude to our devices and phones. Where are our bonuses? Much more could be said about the fascinating dialogues on work and manpower that ensued between Diebold and leading sociologists, psychologists, workers, and unionists of the time, but I want to turn to my provocation. In the same way that automation loomed large over work conversations in the 1950s, with popular works and titles such as Automation, Friend or Foe, and Automation, The Threat and Promise, so too does artificial intelligence today. My provocation starts with a question that I find constantly fascinating and confounding. Why is it that we lurch from fear to enthusiasm and end up rounding to the nearest extreme? It's either our greatest threat or our greatest achievement when it comes to technology in general and artificial intelligence in particular. Why is it not possible to be an enthusiast for the technology, but with important attendant questions and strong reservations based on who is doing the development and the way in which labour is organised to service it? So my particular research focuses on the technology majors, the world's most valuable companies, companies including Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Uber. These companies have played a critical role in redefining improvements in automation, in information retrieval, in what John Diebold identified as the automation of librarian skills with a long history of library science as artificial intelligence. And the nub of my provocation is that the reason we tilt towards fear about unchecked runaway artificial intelligence is because we have unchecked runaway companies spearheading the frontier of artificial intelligence. So stripped of the grand promises, which I think John Diebold's assessment in 56 distill many of the advances that are being made by companies like DeepMind, Uber and Tesla, I think there are a number of challenges that are set out for us. And so I want to just end by isolating some of the challenges that a more grounded understanding of artificial intelligence automation sets for us. The first is that many of the companies developing these technologies operate through apps that facilitate grand pyramid schemes, where precarity, psychological manipulation, and the management of workers by app and algorithmic boss is perpetrated. I think we need to look very closely at the organisation of labour under companies like Uber. There's challenges, there's a big class action, for example, in Australia at the moment on Uber, and how it is that the language and the rhetoric around automation and artificial intelligence actually facilitates grand changes in labour. The second and probably the primary focus of my research is about data. Data is the primary driver of advances in artificial intelligence. At the moment, we have a grand asymmetry at the heart of the data economy. We, as producers of data into our phones, into every aspect of our social lives, have no ownership or control over that data beyond minor rights of privacy, which we know are under assault. In fact, this state is the only one of the only modern states without a Privacy Act. So I think there's a grand challenge because the companies that hoard this data, that drive the frontier of artificial intelligence, can collect it and own it for all time with no costs, no liabilities, no taxes, no intellectual property limits. I think this presents a real challenge when we think about Australia in particular. There's a conceit in many of the conversations about artificial intelligence that we're all going to be the developers of the new technologies. But what should we do as a country that's a net importer of technologies, driven by the data about our citizens? I think there's a great argument to be had about data as the driver of intellectual property and how to appropriately regulate it. The third is around automation and its human costs. There is a grand labour of content moderation that services the shiny, frictionless experiences that we all have with digital technologies. Google and Facebook employ more employees on precarious contracts to manage and sort the absolute scourge of humanity that appears in social media posts and the like. A lot of that work is concentrated in our region of the world, and I think it's incumbent on us to look more closely at it. And the fourth, which I'll end with, is the environmental cost. A lot of the technologies that are driven by data, automation, and artificial intelligence, of course, involve massive computational power. They're massively inefficient. To drive autonomous trucks, for example, across Australia has a significantly greater environmental footprint than human drivers. I think we need to look at the environmental cost, again, particularly as a country that's a net importer of technology, and look at the real consequences as we look at some of the projections that some 30% of the energy utility of the planet will be consumed by cloud computing in the next 10 years, and whether we really are making the kinds of advances that we want to see. I just want to end as my challenge constantly in thinking about improved technology with a quote from the renowned cultural historian Leo Marx. He challenged, does improved technology mean progress? Yes, it could mean just that, but only if we are willing and able to answer the next question. Progress towards what? What is it that we want our new technologies to accomplish? What do we want beyond such immediate, limited goals as achieving efficiencies, decreasing financial costs, and eliminating the troubling human element from our workplaces. We urgently need a set of political, social and cultural goals to accurately assess the worth of new technologies. Otherwise, technological improvements may very well turn out to be incompatible with true, that is to say, social progress.